When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to Nomads Past and Present, a podcast about nomadism and nomadic peoples around the world and throughout history. I'm your host, Maggie Freeman, and my guest today is Judith Lindberg. Judith is an author and creative writing instructor. Her latest novel, Akmaral, which will be published on May 7th by Regal House Publishing, is a historical fiction account of the life of a nomadic warrior woman in Central Asia in the 5th century. And that's what we'll be talking about today. So thank you so much, Judith, for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So first of all, can you just give listeners a brief summary of the book, what it's about, this main character, Akmaral, her story?
Sure. So Akmaral is a nomad woman warrior, and she lives on the Central Asian steppes in the 5th century BCE. She begins as a young girl, and what I try to express is the journey of a child into woman and eventually a leader, facing a culture where warfare is a daily part of life from a very, very young age. And through the novel, she goes through all the stages of development from child to young woman to mother. And at each stage, I confront the questions of the equality of women in this unusual time in history when, at least from the archaeological record, as well as written records of the time, women in this particular culture were warriors and were leaders. And to me, that was an inspiration to recognize that this could be real and we had the evidence to prove it.
Mm-hmm. And so Akmaral is a member of the Saramatai, the Saramation culture, which is one of these, as you just talked about, these sort of Amazon warrior women cultures, as they might be more popularly or better known to people.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about them? You know, what part of the world are we talking about? When? What do we know about their history?
Sure. So most people will know about the Amazons, the women warriors. You know, when I talk to people and I say, you know, Wonder Woman, and then people understand. Of course, Wonder Woman is a comic book character and has a lot of her own history. But in fact, Herodotus in book 4 talks about what happened to the Amazons after the Trojan War. And according to the passage that really is my jumping off place for the novel, after the Trojan War, the defeated Amazons are shipped back home across the Black Sea. And they hijack the ship, as Amazon women would, and kill all the men, toss them overboard. And apparently, they don't know how to sail, so they drift for a while. And eventually crash land at the cliffs of Lake Maeotis, which is in the disputed Crimean Peninsula today, kind of an interesting geographic moment in our time as well. They find a bunch of wild horses and capture them and ride across the steppes. And eventually they run into a band of Scythian warriors, and as is often the case, you know, they start to battle these women who they don't realize are women and right about to destroy them. And suddenly they discover who they are fighting with. So battle turns to courtship. And soon enough, the Amazons accept the men as their lovers. Mm-hmm. And I phrase it that way on purpose. And it is in the writing because the Amazon women, this is not a case of seduction or rape or anything like that. Women are making the choice, and there's a kind of interesting courtship described in the chapter. But after a while, they're rather happily living together on the steppes, and the Scythians want them to come back home with them. And the Amazons say, oh, no, no, we're not going to live like your women who don't have the freedom to battle and hunt and do what they want. You come with us. And they go further east and eventually become the Sauromatae, or the Sarmatians, which are a later incarnation of their people. So that's what Herodotus writes. And I'm sure your listeners know that he didn't actually go to the far Central Asian steppes to meet these people. This is a lot of hearsay. And some of the other passages in the same chapter in Herodotus have some fascinating, kind of almost impossible to believe rumors and of other types of groups and tribes. So we don't know for sure that these Amazons existed or that the Sauromatae existed until archaeology started to dig them up. And for me, the true start of my novel was not Herodotus. That came later. It was this Siberian ice maiden, which is a burial that was discovered in Central Asia. In fact, in the southern part of Siberia, right where Mongolia and Kazakhstan meet, and just north of that, she was discovered in near a village called Pazurik in 1995 by a Russian archaeologist team, and her burial was so extraordinary because it was completely sealed in permafrost for about 2,500 years. So when they found her, they very carefully thawed the permafrost and discovered her burial in this massive larch wood coffin that was 8 feet tall. Her body was incredibly well preserved to the point where we had her skin and her hair and all of her grave goods. She was buried with 6 horses, as well as all kinds of other gold and bronze and everything. But the idea of 6 horses is like 6 Teslas. You've got these are the most valuable things that the nomadic people could give to this woman when she passed. And along with all of the objects and artifacts that were discovered with her, her skin was covered with tattoos. And the tattoos were directly related to the Scythian animal art that is traditional across the entire steppes from the Ukraine all the way into Mongolia. So she's clearly part of this cultural complex. They were able to test her DNA. And despite the fact that she was found in, you know, far, far to the middle of Central Asia, she had Caucasian roots. So that was what the archaeologists and scholars were able to connect her back to Herodotus and the Amazons. The tattoos, the grave goods, the animal style art, and the fact that she was of Caucasian background. And that's what started me thinking about who is this woman and how did she end up there and why was she buried with such extravagance and alone. I mean, there are other graves in this area, but she was in a particularly prominent mound. So the evidence of this woman, which has evolved since I began this novel, in fact, so that's an interesting subject of how, you know, research and additional discoveries change our perspective of what the interpretation is. But at the time, they believed she was a leader. They believed she was some sort of a priestess because she was found with a mirror. Bronze mirrors in these Scythian graves seem to indicate some kind of spiritual connection. And her tattoo also has that quality to it. But then I started doing some research and I started with some, you know, I tend to start with nonfiction, general nonfiction, lay readers materials, because by the time I get into the real depth of it, I need some context. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't familiar with this area at the time. And I discovered Janine Davis Kimball's writing. Her book was called Warrior Women, and it was out in the late 90s. This is a while ago. And she also discussed the Isaac Golden Man, who was he was dug up in Kazakhstan in the 1960s, And he also had these extravagant grave goods. He was had a gold vest made out of arrow-shaped golden objects. And he had all the animal art that, again, is related to the Scythian culture, and a gigantic headdress, like a 3-foot-tall headdress, similar to the Pozaric ice maiden. But what was interesting was at the time, they did not have DNA testing. So they just assumed this person had swords and weaponry in his grave. So he had to be a guy. And unfortunately, there wasn't enough DNA evidence to later test the reality of this presumption. But later scholars, including Davis Kimball, suggested that given the stature of the golden man, also the headdress, which is very similar to what Kazakh brides wear to this day in traditional wedding gear, might have been a woman. This burial might have been a woman. And it's tricky because the Izik Goldman is actually a very important cultural symbol in Kazakhstan. And I don't know that they necessarily doubt the gender or even discuss the gender of this person. But for me, as a novelist, I started to think, well, I have this priestess and I have this warrior. And if this warrior is a woman, what kind of life in this open, empty steppe land did these people have? And the further I dug, literally, into the archaeological research, the more I found, time after time, women warriors whose bodies were clearly wounded in battle, laid to rest with arrowheads and swords and daggers and all kinds of weaponry. And they were buried with honors and grave goods that indicated that they were important people to their culture. Mm-hmm. So I started to imagine the life of this conflated burial of these, at least the two, if not many of these others, and tried to create a story around their lives.
Mm-hmm. And so you touched on sort of two things there that I'm interested in talking more about, which is the combination of sort of academic scholarly research and filling in the missing details with your imagination, you know, as a writer. And, you know, as someone who is today an academic historian, my interest in history as a child definitely started out with reading historical fiction, like your books. And something that I have a new appreciation for, I think, as an adult, knowing what I know now, when I go back and look at some of the historical fiction that I was like obsessed with as a kid, is, yes, I'm now able to identify where authors are taking creative liberties in the interest of telling a compelling story and are filling mm-hmm. in those gaps in the historical record with their imagination. Mm-hmm. But I'm also, I think, better able to appreciate just how much research actually does go into writing historical fiction. And I think often in an even more granular way than academic research often necessitates. But obviously, you know, a problem for writing about the time periods and the peoples of your novels, and maybe especially of this novel, is that problem of a lack of sources, which is a problem that obviously academic researchers face as well. And the difficulties in researching histories of nomadic peoples is, you know, this has come up in every interview that I've ever done on this podcast. Yeah. But, you know, for academics, when we don't know something about nomadic peoples in history, we can just say we don't know. This information doesn't exist in either the archaeological or documentary record. Obviously, we can conjecture, we can speculate, but sort of the point of academic integrity at a certain point is to sort of draw a line and say, we don't know this, we can't know this. Mm-hmm. But as a fiction writer, I feel like you don't have that kind of get out of jail free card. You can't just say, well, you know, we don't know what a certain religious practice looked like, or we don't know exactly what social hierarchies were enforced, so I'm just going to leave those details out. That option isn't available to you, because that's then to the detriment of the reader's experience and to the detriment of your world building in your writing. So how do you approach that? How do you reconcile that? How do you kind of handle the details that we simply do not know and cannot know about people's lives in the past? Is that really coming for your own imagination? Are you sort of kind of trying to make an informed guess about what certain things would have looked like? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. That's one of the pleasures, I think, of fiction is I get to take all this research and connect it and make those leaps of faith that if I were strictly an academic researcher, I would be loath to do. But you can see the possibilities. And so for Akhmaral, I went in a lot of different directions to fill in those unique blanks. I mean, first of all, I started with the Amazons and being a matriarchal culture. Mm-hmm. And there is evidence in the archaeological record that implies, at least in these particular places, there was a matriarchal culture. And you can actually see the transition from matriarchy to patriarchy. So that became a critical question of, first of all, how does this matriarchal culture work? And what happens when a patriarchal intrusion enters that world? So one of the things I really was clear on was that the Sauromatai had men in there because the Scythians were there. They all went off by themselves. So I didn't want to have it like only women. And that wasn't the story I wanted to tell. I wanted to sort of say, well, how do we integrate a pantheon of female leadership? And the pantheon, I call her Radamai, which is based on some very obscure scholarship that I used. But basically, the central god worship is the hearth, Hestia, mm-hmm. According to Herodotus's comparisons to the Greeks. So I wanted the hearth goddess to be the central kind of most important spiritual feature. And I wanted their war god, whom I call Targitai, to be subservient to Hestia Radamai's perspective. And these were all indicated in some of the archaeology, some of the writing, and I just decided that that would enable a female leadership to be central to the characters. There are male leaders as well, but the most important leader of the group throughout the narrative happens to be a woman. And the other things that I kind of create, well, I need to understand what their belief systems are. I need to understand how their day-to-day lives are. The day-to-day lives, I went to much more modern cultures of nomadic peoples who live in Mongolia and Kazakhstan and these areas, even today. And yes, most people live in cities, and I get that, but there's people who still have their sheep and their horses up in the mountains, and they go and they travel to the good pastures and come back and during the cold weather. And I said, well, we can utilize that tradition and impose it upon the past. And there's also archaeological and even petroglyphs that show petroglyphs from thousands of years prior to this that show people living in yurts or gurs, that show people hunting with bows and arrows. So we know that this is a continuum across multiple cultural shifts all the way into the present day and the Nadam festival, which is celebrated in Mongolia, where they do horse racing and archery and wrestling. And I used all of those sort of fascinating, real modern things that I could watch on videos and, you know, on my YouTube, and create a culture and a tradition that had authenticity to the cultural reality. It's not the same as what is happening today. I'm deconstructing a lot of modern or even not so modern. I took some things from the Mongol Empire, but not so much because that's a very different objective entirely. Some from the Huns, some from Tamerlane, all kinds of different details that I could reconstruct in a more ancient culture and a much more insulated, tiny group of people. The idea that the Sauromatai were some sort of huge tribe, I'm literally at the beginning of the book, it's like six or seven families living together. And traveling with their herds and traveling with their people and following the good grass, as they say in the book. And the vulnerability of that felt like a family to me, instead of a larger national construct. It's just a bunch of people trying to survive. And the vulnerability also enabled the implicit requirement of self-defense. And there's always somebody coming for their grass and with their own herds. And if the situation, if they can get along and there's like enough room for everyone, there's no problem. But if they are desperate and need to attack to survive, or for some other reason that isn't even, they don't know why they're being attacked, the people in the Akmarel's small group need to fight back. And therefore, it makes complete sense to me that everyone would be trained to some extent to be able to defend themselves. But also the training is not just for warfare or defense, it's for hunting. So early in the book, we have the young children going off on their horses to learn to hunt. And things happen on that hunt. I won't go into the details, but they're living off the land. Mm-hmm. They're living with their herds and horses, but they also are hunting for wild beasts and food, and they have to practice these skills from a very young age. And even today in nomadic cultures in the region, they put their kids on horses before they can walk, which sounds crazy, but that's what they do. And sounds crazy to us, but that's how you get along. You've got to be able to travel and ride, keep your seat, and be comfortable living the daily life. It's as easy as walking or knowing to put your seatbelt on if you're in a car. So I really researched in every possible direction. Spiritually, I went also into the Scythian art to discover a really interesting Bronze Age monument era. There are multiple monuments in Mongolia called deer stones, and there are these stela that are carved with a similar deer-shaped animal, which looks just like the tattoo that was on the Ice Maiden's arm. And researchers have discovered a connection to this Bronze Age and earlier Bronze Age culture. So I was going both east and west, and I was going backward and forward in time. And I wanted to really connect this complex of peoples as inheriting the belief systems and the traditions of the shamanic cultures and animistic cultures that have been living in the Central Asian steppes for millennia.
Yeah, I think it's also worth noting, and I'm sure you have thought about this as well, that the landscape of the Central Asian steppe is not dissimilar from landscapes in North America, right? Like the Great Plains. And so I think, this history might seem very unfamiliar, very alien in a lot of ways to, English speaking contemporary audiences, but really, and I don't want to, conflate all nomadic peoples into one, but certainly there are similarities in how indigenous Native American groups, approach things like education and what skills need to be instilled among young people and living off of the land, subsistence methods, things like that. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely elements of the lifestyles of the Saramatai that come up in your book that should not be actually that foreign to us in our kind of current context.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. In fact, sometimes in order to get myself in the right frame of mind to write, I would use music from the region, which I usually listen to Tuvan throat singing, which is from that same exact area. And if you listen to Tuvan throat singing, some of the more upbeat stuff, it sounds like they're riding a horse. And it sounds a little like kind of Western, American Western music. And it makes me laugh because there is a connection. And it's a logical connection. If faced with a particular kind of environment, you have to solve problems utilizing the same sort of logic. And it's not at all unbelievable that there would be similarities. There are distinct and important differences. And, I wanted to try to honor those uniquenesses. But any culture trying to survive on the land has to solve the same sets of problems, and many of them come up with similar solutions.
Yeah. So were there certain elements from the historical record that you maybe deliberately discarded or chose not to include? Were there certain things in Herodotus where you were like, that doesn't quite work for the story I want to tell, or this is like interesting to know, but maybe I'm not going to put it in there? Was there anything like that where you're like, this is good to know, but actually it doesn't fit with the story I want to tell for whatever reason?
Well, interestingly, what I mostly tossed out were the classic stories that we know about Amazons. I didn't want to go into Penthesilea, and I didn't want to go into Achilles and Heracles. I love those stories and I respect those stories, but I wanted to tell something that was a little bit more ancient and earthbound. And even though I think ancient's not quite the right word, but we hear those stories, we know those stories, they're part of our Western canon if we read the classics. And I felt like the archaeology was what was really driving me. So there's some fascinating artifacts from the burials. There's a beautiful felt applique work where there's a woman sitting on a throne with a branch and a man on horseback coming to her. And so it's clear that she is the important personage in this meeting. And he's on the horse, but she's the one with the scepter in a way. The branch is like a scepter. And we don't know who this person is. We don't know who the horseman is. And I just said, well, what is the event that I can more immortalize from this artifact and give breath and life to? I utilize the archaeological discovery of the Pazaric rug, which is the oldest pile rug ever discovered and preserved in history. And I utilize that in a scene when it is presented to Akhmaral. I really wanted to... the mirror that is, it's not the same mirror that was found with the Pazaric Ice Maiden. It's another mirror because it had, it was etched with the flying deer imagery that was on her shoulder. And it's on the cover of my book, which is lovely. And I really wanted to use that as a spiritual symbol. So I gave that object to one of her most important mentors. And eventually it comes down to her. So I kind of didn't dismiss, but I set aside the more Western Greek history and legends, and I really took from the ground, from the bones and the artifacts of the Central Asia, which felt to me, you know, they're material evidence. They're not hearsay. That somebody really died. Somebody really made this object and put it in the grave with this person. And while the documentary evidence is valuable and undeniably influential in our culture, the artifacts are there. And I wanted to bring them back to life.
And so maybe you just answer this, maybe not. But what's the appeal of writing historical fiction for you? Your other novel, The Thrall's Tale, is about the Vikings in 9th century Greenland. Mm-hmm. So there's a theme here. So do you have a background in history? Is it just something you've always been interested in? What's the draw of writing about the past for you?
You know, my background is not at all in this. My original profession was performer. I was a dancer and an actor. And I started writing because I was bored at my temp jobs and had to look busy, which is kind of horrifying, but it worked. But I have always been fascinated by ancient history from the earliest days. I think in third grade, we learned about Greece and Rome. And ever since then, I've been reading mythology and archaeology and anthropology. And I just find ancient history so vivid and vital. And so the more I understand it, the more I see the humanity of it. And I'm trying to wrestle with how did people survive in these places that I know I couldn't survive in, certainly not in Central Asia and absolutely not in Greenland when the Vikings first landed there. I keep going to places that intimidate me. And I think as a writer, I'm trying to understand how people survived. and how women lived and how women confronted the limitations or opportunities of their gender and their culture. So in my first novel, it is about women, it's about three women in Viking Age Greenland. And one of them is a slave. And part of the inspiration for that was the idea that, you know, many cultures have experienced slavery across history. And also when you're in an isolated place where there's no escape and you have to contend with the realities of that lifestyle. And I also take, I do a deep focus on the transition from paganism to Christianity in that novel and what happens when, what happens to the people who are believers in the old ways as they shift and have to live through that change. Where in Akmaral, I think the fascination again, and both novels were deeply archaeological in their roots. I mean, there's a whole lot more documentary evidence on the Vikings than there is on the Sarumatai. But I really found archaeology to be key to giving me character moments. There, in the Thrall's Tale, there is a particular rune stick. It's literally a stick that somehow survived. And it has a mysterious kind of magical inscription on it. And nobody quite knows what it is. And I incorporated that into a character and speculated, because nobody knows what it is, what it might have meant. And that allowed me to deepen my understanding or my imagining of their spiritual pagan practices. With Akmaral, I really felt like every piece of evidence, and there's so much material. Each gold plaque has that I discovered had these straining beasts and wild animals with, you know, attacking creatures. And I felt this deep connection to the animal culture of Central Asia. So I used that to speculate about the animals themselves and whether they had a sort of spiritual component. And there is an element in the novel of magic realism where Akmaral confronts directly beasts that, you know, would probably kill her. And there's a deeper spiritual and psychic connection between her and the animals that are her sustenance and her threat. There's also eagle hunting, which, if anyone saw the movie The Eagle Huntress, was like out like 5-6 years ago. It's a great movie about a young girl who in contemporary Kazakhstan is an eagle hunter. But I utilized that, which is also evidenced in the petroglyphs in the archaeology, to show another way to interact with wild beasts and to harness them in a way that is both valuable to humans and somewhat of a threat, and also a question of our morality, of what is our relationship with the wild animals around us. So I'm wrestling with all of these sort of questions of humanity's relationship with nature, humanity's evolution in beliefs, and our understanding of social structures. Why have men, you know, in most of Western culture been the leaders? What is the purpose of patriarchy? How did it come into play? Where was the moment where the shift came from women being the central power, if there is evidence of other matriarchies throughout time? And how did that happen? And why did that happen? And how did we allow it to happen? And is it to the benefit of all or not? Mm-hmm. So I'm really playing with all of these questions that I have, and I feel that they come out of the research and the archaeology.
Mm-hmm. And you said that part of the appeal of writing about the past for you is understanding and kind of grappling with things that intimidate you. Does that include, you know, do you find it necessary or helpful for your writing process to actually sort of physically experience those intimidating things? Or is it enough to just do that, you know, in your mind? You know, I know of authors who write about topics like this who are like, I'm going to learn how to ride horses. I'm going to learn how to hunt, that sort of thing. Is that part of your process, or is it much more of a kind of mental or internal one for you?
It's a little bit of both, to be honest. I mean, I don't hunt. I don't want to kill anything. I'm like the most peaceful person you'll ever find. But I definitely did as much horseback riding as I could throughout the writing of the novel. I'm not a good horsewoman at all, but I would go out whenever I had a chance. I also, I got a child's bow and arrow. And this was because my kids were little when this book began, and I had a lot of sort of kid-related things. So sometimes we would take branches and we'd make bows and arrows in the backyard, and I would find feathers and we'd fletch them, and my kids, you know, did all this crazy stuff with me. But I did eventually get a bow and arrow, and I wanted to feel what it felt like to be an archer. And so I had one of those little play school colorful slides that my kids were using in the backyard. I turned it backward, and I had the baby mattress that used to be on my kids' bed. They had grown out of it, and I stuck it against the steps, and I used it as a target, and I would practice shooting just to get the feeling of it. Mm-hmm. And I never got really good. In fact, at one point I overshot and it went straight through my neighbor's PVC fence. And I was like, okay, I can't do this in the backyard anyway. He was very understanding about it. Very nice of him. So I did try to learn those skills. I also, you know, learned how to make felt. You can actually, if you get lint from your dryer, you can make a very fragile mm-hmm. sort of felt. There's better ways to do it, but at least I tried to practice the skills that my characters would need. And I have a theoretical knowledge of how to build a yurt. I kept trying to get my husband and I to do it, and he's like, "You're not putting a yurt in our backyard, honey." I'm like, "Come on." So, I do as much as I physically can to recreate the skills, and I have been known to act my characters out in my office in the private when the door is closed, because I'm crazy. But I definitely want to make it as authentic as possible, and I feel like maybe as the actor in me, I need to feel it in my body to do it. But no animals or other things were killed in the writing of this novel.
Important disclaimer.
Yeah, very important. You know, also one of the hard things for me is facing a battle scene, because there's a lot of battle scenes in this novel by necessity. And I was really, one of the things about Akmarel is she is not a bloodthirsty warrior. She does not want power. She does not want to kill. It's not one of those sort of cliche stories. Whenever she's confronted with the reality of violence, she has to gird herself and get herself ready. And I had to do the same thing. So when I was getting ready to write a battle scene, I had this particular kind of tube and throat singing, which is more of a dirge. And I would put it on and I'd just close my eyes and I'd let the heaviness and the deep droning vibrations enter my body. And it felt like I was propelling my spirit to enter the battle that she was facing. And she never revels in violence or death. That's a critical thing in her story. I mean, she's always focused on protecting her people. Mm-hmm. And that's her key motivation, whether it's when she's a child protecting her small group, whether she's protecting her own intimate family, or ultimately making choices to try to dispel and dissuade from the violence. Mm-hmm. So I felt like she needed to have that weight and that questioning of, why are we doing this? How can we do better? How can we protect our people and not have to do it through violence? And that it leads her to making certain choices in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important way to portray nomadic people, even if it is your kind of, you know, fictionalized imagining of a specific person in the past. Mm-hmm. Certainly it's the kind of dominant image of the ancient Central Asian steppe peoples today is of this particularly violent and bloodthirsty one, like the Mongols, the Mongol Empire, you know, Genghis Khan, the really sort of like often over-exaggerated violence of the Mongol conquest sort of looms large in our popular and cultural imagination of what those peoples are like. And I think our imagination of what that sort of lifestyle is like, what the landscape is like, and the violence that it seems to engender and seems to necessitate. And of course, that's not true at all. And of course, the reality is much more nuanced than that, as so many things are. So I think it's, I really appreciated reading a much more kind of balanced depiction of what nomadic lifestyles are like and can be like to counteract that narrative of just sheer inescapable violence 24/7, and to make nomadic peoples in the past a little bit more accessible, more human to the modern reader, rather than just these kind of one-dimensional, you know, warrior tropes. And so I appreciated having this depiction of someone who is a warrior, but who also struggles with that, or who has, you know, more going on as a human being than just being this violent killer.
Yeah. Yeah. I really am glad you saw that in the novel. It was such a critical part of what I was trying to express. And, you know, I mean, I have also done quite a bit of research into the Mongol Empire, and for a while I was considering writing a book about them. And part of the difficulty for me was the element of scale. Like, if you look at the early life of Genghis Khan and you recognize sort of what was happening with his family and how hard he was trying just to survive and some of his violent choices, you can almost justify, if you understand the nuances of the history. It's later when it feels like the only way to keep the tribes and the clans engaged was to keep more and more violence that I was like, okay, I can't write this one. This one gets just too, I really believe in the humanity of my characters and I'm trying to find the complexity in the historical life. And I want to, I also think the violence is a matter of scale. So when Akhmaral's people are just this little six or seven families, it makes sense. You know, someone comes into your neighborhood and starts vandalizing, you're going to like try to stop them.
Defend yourself.
But when there's hundreds or thousands of people, how do you maintain that cohesion? And how do you control ambitions and conflicts of interest? And, you know, it gets much more difficult. So I think when we look at the Mongol story, it's a very different social construct. Yeah. And part of what I loved about Akhmaral was to be able to watch her grow and try to expand her beliefs about violence and its purpose and turn them from violence into an attempt at cohesion.
Interesting. Yeah. So that maybe segues into my next or my final question, I think, as we're coming up on the end of our time, you know, which is that obviously, you know, you're writing this for a modern readership. So what did you want readers to take away from this novel beyond maybe just learning a bit about ancient Central Asia? you know, what messages or themes are woven into this story that you think have relevance for us today? What did you hope that the reader would maybe learn about themselves or would reflect on about our current society through this lens of the past?
Yeah. Interestingly, this story began because I had little boys. And one of my little boys, who's now grown, for 2 years he thought he was a knight in shining armor because I took him to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the medieval wing. And then, like, for 2 years he would be out in the backyard practicing jousting and with his stick horse. It was crazy. And I didn't want him to play violent games. I wanted him to be a gentle, you know, person. And part of what I came to terms with him was writing this novel about embracing our violent nature, but also recognizing the power of my own mothering instinct. So I twisted my anxiety over his childish play, and he's a lovely young man, trust me. But I twisted that anxiety into, well, what would I fight for? What would I die for? And all I had to do was look at my kids, and I'm like, yeah, do not get in the way of my children or you're dead. So I felt like it was the mothering instinct in me. If there was anything true about, well, what would we all protect with our lives? And it would be the people we love. And I feel like if you can see that deep mothering instinct in respect for the hearth, respect for the home, respect for the family, that violence, and even if we scale it up to global nationalism, which gets so complicated, we're ultimately protecting our little tiny family, except it's gotten out of control. And if we can, instead of perceiving the other as the enemy, but embrace and find their humanity, which is part of the narrative that Akramal goes through, find the humanity in the other, find the mothering, caring love and protection for more than just the person who lives in your house or in your neighborhood, but for the rest of the humanity, we might be able to redirect our violent nature and our contentiousness, and maybe for half a minute make a better world, which is sort of what I wanted for Akramal. And I won't tell how the book ends, but that was like what she was trying for.
Wow, very powerful note to end on. Thank you. As a reminder to listeners, Akramal will be published on May 7th. Please check it out if you're interested in reading a fictionalized, but nonetheless, as you can tell, extremely well-researched account of the life of a nomadic warrior woman in Central Asia in the 5th century BC. So thank you so much, Judith, for coming on to talk to me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.